officially good morning. And we make just a start on the topic of curriculum last time. We established that we're talking about the proper curriculum for primary and secondary education. And we want to say what it should be. The main problem with defining curriculum is it must be rigidly delimited. Time is finite. The child can learn only so much in the periods at his disposal. And if a subject is to be of any value, it must be explored leisurely in depth. The concept that they have today in education of unintegrated, lightning-like, quote, surveys, which is masses of disorganized data thrown at the student from dozens of fields and then forgotten, is completely useless. That is harmful. That just overloads the circuits. The idea from the Renaissance was much better. You take a few subjects, a small number, 3, 4, that's it, and you do it in depth. You really teach and they really learn to think in those areas. That trains minds and that builds a foundation. And nothing else does. But that then requires a rigorous selectivity about the curriculum. And there is another reason for delimiting. Every subject that you teach implicitly conveys a value message to the students. You're saying, in effect, given our limited time, this is important. This is important to know, as important as the other things you're studying. So if you teach folk dancing or finger painting as a subject on a par with math, for instance, you are giving a deadly message to the student, what we can call cognitive egalitarianism. Which means you are really treating serious subjects with implicit contempt. You're saying about every other subject, it's no more worthwhile than folk dance. Now, if you had the slightest idea what is taught in today's schools as part of the curriculum, I leave aside how it's taught, but simply what is taught, you would run screaming from the room. This is from a Dallas newspaper survey of what is taught in Dallas, and I just read some paragraphs at random. Physical education, music performance, driver education, cooperative education, these are separate courses for credit and so on. Health education, general shop, training for marriage, vocational home economics. And one guy put his son in North Dallas into a class. And then here's the quote. This year, his counselor put him in a mass media course, and they spent their time watching Busby Berkeley movies. Now, I can't understand why anybody should spend any time in school watching Busby Berkeley movies. I believe that you can't get enough basic education. But he was denounced by the advocates of, and I quote just a bit more here, these are all course titles. General plastics, general ceramics, general jewelry, and general leather. And as a commentator points out, it sounds like the Joint Chiefs of Staff in a Mel Brooks movie. There is also courses for credit. For credit in school newspaper, yearbook, football, cheerleading, and drill team. To say nothing of creative photography, general photography, and advanced photography. Well, I just can't take the time to go on, but you can from that get just the faintest concept. Leaving aside every other problem, this kind of curriculum is the death of education, the complete end of it. And the moral that I draw from this is, just because you like a subject, it does not follow it should be in the curriculum. Just because a subject has some value, even some practical value, like driver education, it does not follow that it should be included. There should be a clear division between the essential work of education and then, if there's time, some frills, some sidelines, some extracurricular stuff. But education as such is a very specific process. It's to train the conceptual faculty. Only those subjects essential for that purpose should be included. Now, in my opinion, a proper curriculum comes down to the three R's plus four subjects, and that's it. I'll give you a few minutes to guess what the four subjects are, and I'll lead you to them one at a time. So this means, to put it negatively, a tremendous impoverishment of the curriculum. There's a vast amount of stuff, so I do not believe in being taught. And I want to now just go over these. Of course, for each of these areas that I mentioned, there's a lot of questions that we could discuss. What aspect of each subject should be taught, by what methods, with what motivation, and so on. You could give a whole lecture, for instance, just on the teaching of reading. But I want to give just on each of these some brief comments to relate the area to a conceptual education, to show its place therein. I want to really just explain why I include each of these and how it, if properly taught, it would relate to the definition of education that we gave at the outset. Now, the three R's are pretty obvious, I think, and we can go through them quickly. Reading. Reading, of course, is intimately tied to writing. And in my judgment, the most important thing to read is your own writing. So I see reading as a necessary adjunct of writing, your own writing, and I'm going to make a big song and dance about writing shortly. But of course, beyond your own writing, reading is really the key to entering the conceptual world. It's the means of access to the sum of human knowledge so far, the means of independent access to the accumulated knowledge and ideas of the whole of human history. And as such, it's indispensable to every other subject, and of course, to practical life in a conceptual society. If you cannot read, you are to conceptual knowledge like a blind man is to the visual world. You can perhaps take a few halting steps under the guidance of some literate seeing eye dog, but you're essentially helpless. That's too obvious to require discussion. As to how to teach reading, I just say flatly it should be the phonics method, absolutely not the look-say. Now let's jump to arithmetic for a moment. I think that's also obvious. Numbers, I refer you here to Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, are an essential aspect of the conceptual process. The child learns to count as he learns to speak. Arithmetic is merely the elementary operations with numbers. So it is like literacy in relation to numbers. And without it, you are deprived of an indispensable aspect of the conceptual faculty. And of course, you're horribly hampered in practical life as well. Now, the deeper justification of arithmetic will be when we get to mathematics, but for now, just the minimal, obvious reason for that. Now let's get to writing. Now here I want to say more, because I think writing is widely misunderstood and not appreciated in the United States. In the United States, writing is taught in something called English classes. And generally speaking, it is regarded that you can write if you can sign your name, form letters and words, and write a thank you note to your uncle. I have in mind a very different concept, a much broader concept of writing. Writing as a tool of life, writing as a tool of thought that is not restricted to, quote, English classes. As a writing as a skill that is essential to every single subject bar none, and that is a continuous part of the curriculum. So this is writing in the sense of composition, but composition in the very broadest sense, not composition as my summer vacation or one of those junky topics. Every subject, I stress, even mathematics should include massive amounts of writing. Now there can be a separate English department to teach certain rudiments, such as grammar, punctuation, spelling. But in essence, I do not believe writing should be the monopoly of any one department or subject matter. I think every subject, and I tried to do this when I was teaching, should be given two grades. The student should be given on every paper and in every course. One on the content of that subject, and the other on his ability to express it in writing. Every teacher in that sense should be an English teacher. And whether he's getting an essay in physics or whatever it happens to be, he should give it one grade for writing, one grade for the factual content. Now, why do I make writing such a big thing? I do not believe that writing is just for writers or professional intellectuals. I think it is a necessity of mind training, a necessity of learning the proper use of concepts, a necessity of learning exact logical thought. I'll put the point to you this way. You may speak well. That is not enough for an education as we defined it at the outset of this course. It is impossible, in my opinion, to organize your thoughts on any complex subject strictly by the spoken word, without the use of written formulations, without making notes, without writing down your points. And my reason for that statement is there are too many aspects to any complex thinking process for speaking to enable you to keep them before you, to keep them separate, and enable you to identify those aspects. There's just simply too much. You must get your thinking first before you, in some shape that you can hold, and slowly go over and review and study from different aspects. And the reason for this is the crow epistemology. There's so much when you say something aloud, you simply cannot scrutinize it from all those aspects at once and still retain. Now, I allow conceivably as a kind of science fiction possibility that someone could play a tape of himself speaking, have a photographic memory, and keep on playing and replaying it, but I think that would be very onerous. Practically speaking, when you want to subject your thought to analysis, you have to ask many questions of context, logic, integration. Did I establish the context? What did I take for granted? Did I assume too much? Does my argument really hold water? Does this point follow from the preceding? Why exactly this point? Why do I use this wording? Did I make all the key connections? Can I see other connections between my points? What are my key points? And how do they relate to one another? Did I claim the right assessment to my knowledge? Was it really certain or only probable, etc.? Now, you cannot hold all this in mind in any one process. The only method to do it is to write, blurt it out, get some ideas, some organization down, and then you query, you scrutinize, you check, you evaluate, you rewrite. And the rewriting is not just for others, it is primarily for you yourself, because it is a process of making your own thought clearer, more logical, more exact. You constantly say to yourself, do I know the definition of this term I'm using? Is this claim really justified? Why did I use this word? Or what really is my point here? Why is this passage even necessary? What does it add? Is this sentence really clear to me, or did I just put it in because I've heard people say it? What's the relation between this example and that, etc., etc.? That is what rewriting consists of, answering those questions and revising accordingly. And all of that is really checking the quality of your thought. You cannot distinguish between perfecting your thinking and perfecting your writing. So I would say editing or revising is the process of perfecting your thinking, and there is no other way to do it. Ayn Rand, as you know, first thought out Atlas Shrugged thoroughly. She had very, very, very detailed, extensive notes. She had massive written formulations of all of her key points, and then she rewrote every single page 5 times. And that was not only for style. That was thinking. Every reformulation made it clearer to her, included relationships that she hadn't seen from before, exhibited other aspects to her. Editing, in that sense, is thinking. It gives you the chance for precision, clarity, logic that is not comparably achievable in speaking. Now, many Americans think you just blurt out something, and of course for you that's clear, and then you have to revise it because there's arbitrary rules of writing. This is a fundamental mistake in what thinking consists of. I have had an experience many, many times, and I'm sure those of you who write have had. You give a lecture orally, the way I'm doing it now, from just, you know, extemporaneous notes, and you feel you're being completely clear, the class nods, everything is fine, and then you have to write it down, actually, word for publication. You learn a tremendous amount each time. You find so many things that struck you as you were speaking. That's clear, and the audience got it, it was clear, and it wasn't clear. But it's too much, too fast. You simply can't untangle it all. Therefore, I'm the staunchest advocate of essay writing in every subject. I think every teacher, and if a parent wants to be part of the process, every parent has to be an editor in this large sense. You must have a check of the thinking quality of the student. Now, I'm not speaking just of formal grammar. I'm speaking of actually subjecting the thought process to analysis. Now, it should, in that sense, you should, as a parent or as a teacher, if it's physically feasible, all education should be tutorial. And my idea of tutorial, you know, one-on-one, is not in the form of presenting the material, but in going over the student's writing. to me, that is the best way to teach. That's the way I learned the most. I learned philosophy by going through that with Ayn Rand. I would hand in papers to her, or drafts of articles, or sections from the Ominous Parallels, and she would just disintegrate it. I mean, she would say, why this, and why this, and how did you get here, and what about this jump, and what are you assuming there, and do you know what this implies, etc. She would subject any one paragraph, like even I gave her even undergraduate school papers. And I got an idea what thinking consisted of simply from her critical evaluations of junk that I wrote. I mean, it was just, you know, school paper that you bat out. But what she could see in it was simply fantastic to me. Now, I don't say that you should subject a youngster to that kind of relentless surgical probing because you'll petrify him. It has to be according to his ability, and you have to feed him the appropriate praise and so on. But I do say there is no educational method in any subject comparable to this. Now, I have to go on because we can't do the whole thing on writing, although that would itself, I think, be very instructive. But I want to give you just two tips very briefly if you want to teach writing in this way to your students or your children. Do not just assign a topic. Go over with the student in advance as many things as you can think of. Help him with the exploratory thinking. In other words, delimit the topic. Know enough about what you're assigning so he doesn't take on something so huge that he sprawls hopelessly. Discuss possible structure with him. What point should come before what? If you want him to consider objections, let him try and think with you. What kind of objections should he discuss in his writing? What kind of interconnections? In other words, do some of the exploratory work so you don't just give him some vast topic and then he's floundering completely. And then, when he submits, the second main tip, when he submits a piece of writing, take it seriously. Always treat it as though it was published work. From grade one on up, never treat it as a school paper or just something the kid did. Be very serious, very frank, and very blunt within the understanding that you have to be kind to the kid. But you tell him, Well, I see this point, but I don't get this. Why? What do you mean here? Why this word? Why not that word? Now, you know, you have to do it in scale, but you have to treat it, if I can use this phrase, as a religious exercise. This is a very, very serious stuff. The kid has to learn the importance of intellectual rigor, and this is the only way that he is basically going to learn it. Otherwise, if you did this typical way of going over these papers is to put a few grammatical comments in the margin and then say fine or good self-expression or some stupid comment at the end, that simply teaches contempt for the whole process. Now, I'm sorry for blowing our discussion of writing up so long, but I had to get that out of my system. Now I want to look at the four main subject areas that I recognize as essential. They're all developments of the three arts. I have no special order. Well, in a way I do, but not really. So I'm going to start with mathematics. I do believe that some mathematics is essential. Mathematics is often described as the language of thought, and this is true in the sense that Ayn Rand made clear in Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology. I do not mean that every subject must be quantified. I do not mean, you know what they do in psychology today, that nothing is knowledge unless you can say 3.8 milligrams of self-esteem minus 6.8, whatever. That's all nonsense. I mean the basic fact that there is an essential tie between conceptualization and measurement. Mathematics is the science of measurement, and concepts, as you know, involve a form of measurement most essential. In both cases, mathematics and conceptualization, there is one essential common denominator. You're bringing the whole universe within the scale of human cognition. You're taking a vast complexity that is perceptually ungraspable, and you're reducing it to a manageable, comprehensible sum. That's the essence of what they both have in common. You know the example, we measure the distance to the sun. It's ungraspable on the perceptual level. You can't make anything of that, it's unknowable. Most gigantic, unknowable quantities and make them observable and graspable by reduction to the perceptual. Well, that is exactly what the conceptual process is. You take man, meaning all men, past, present, and future. That is a totality incomprehensible on the perceptual level. Ungraspable. You simply can't take it in. But by implicitly measuring those that you can perceive, that is comparing them quantitatively on a continuum. You take a few. One is taller, one is shorter, one is fatter, one is thinner, one has more creases, and the other has fewer creases in his forehead, etc., etc. But appropriately done, you abstract, you omit the measurements, and you thereby form the abstraction man, which brings the whole totality into your knowledge. For the details of that, of course, I have to refer you to Ms. Rand's book. But that is the nub of the process. Properly taught, mathematics should be like a blueprint of the use of the conceptual faculty. It should be like a naked, stripped-down version of what all conceptualization is. And if it were taught this way, there would be no question of motivating students in the importance of learning the subject. If you suddenly get to algebra, and the teacher just comes in and says, well, now we say A and B instead of 5 and 6, or X and Y, and we have a whole bunch of mysterious rules of equations, that, of course, is unintelligible, unmotivated, and purposeless. But if you introduce it via comparing the relation of concepts to percepts, and higher concepts to lower concepts, and then you see that algebra is related to arithmetic and to perceptual data in exactly the same way. In other words, we have this table, that table, that table. Then we have the concept table, and the concept here. And then we have the higher concept furniture. And in the same way, we have this concrete and that one and that one. And then we abstract numbers, 5 and 6 and 7. And then we go to a unit like A, which stands for all the numbers, 5, 6, 7. So A is to 5 and 6, just what furniture and the higher concepts are to table and chair. If it's taught that way, that obviously is the tiniest taste. Then you see that what we're really doing is an x-ray of the nature of thought, the pure method of a unit reduction with the content abstracted away. And then a student necessarily has to have respect for mathematics and an illumination of the whole conceptual process. Now, of course, this requires teaching mathematics in relation to reality, to the physical world, to real concretes, not as floating Platonic abstractions. The evil example here, Harry Binswanger already mentioned, non-Euclidean geometries and the way they're taught. In fact, mathematics should be taught in conjunction with real problems in science and engineering. And I don't mean phony make-work examples. But the student should learn from mathematics how measurement actually opened up the whole physical world to us, how it laid bare and exposed laws that we otherwise could never have grasped. If you want to teach squares, how can you teach squares and motivate a class without teaching the law of gravitation, what they learn from the ability of multiplying two quantities to each other, and everything we're able to do on that basis? If mathematics should be taught as the key to understanding the universe, along with being invaluable training in conceptualization, and then you would not have math anxiety and the hopelessness of the subject. And there's one more related value to mathematics. Mathematics is the clearest example that there is, the clearest of logical rigor. Of course, every subject is logical. But mathematics as a purely deductive structure is the most obvious example of it. So it is the best single example in the whole curriculum of structure. And we're trying to teach structure. It's not an accident that Aristotle formulated logic on the basis of the math that was known, and that was the only science that was really known at his time. A student who grasps a proof in math gets an invaluable training in rigor, precision and logic that he cannot really get comparably elsewhere. Now, there are many questions about how much math to teach. I have to leave that to experts in the field, because you could argue, you can't go on through differential equations and so on the general level. To me, as an ignorant person, it seems at a minimum that algebra and geometry should be taught. I cannot tell you a view on trigonometry and calculus that depends on a mathematician who would be able to establish for me that it can be done at a certain age, that it doesn't take away too much time for the rest, and that it adds a tremendous amount. I leave that open. My guess is that properly taught, kids can learn an awful lot more than they learn right now. Now let us go to the second of the four subjects that I recommend. Now this is suspense now, right? History. Now, I define history in this context as the study of man through his past actions. Now observe that at least half of all cognition is the study of man in some aspect. That's the whole half that we call the humanities and the social sciences. And this is necessarily so if you are teaching human beings. A man has to discover who he is in order to be able to think properly. He must have some self-understanding, some grasp of the nature of man. Otherwise, he cannot choose actions, values, or live his life. In that sense, without some knowledge of himself, his faculty of consciousness would be cut off from directing his actions, which means would be cut off from reality. So the only question that the curriculum can ask is, which subject, will best introduce the student to the whole realm of the humanities and social sciences. In other words, to the question of the nature of man. And my answer is history. The best entry to the study of man. All the other humanities and social sciences, in my opinion, are, well, all but for one, are too abstract, too theoretical for the early years. For a young child, all these others are necessarily floating. He has no factual basis yet to tie them to reality. For example, you could not teach political theory to an 8-year-old or a 12-year-old, not properly, because he has no way to judge or evaluate competing theories. There is no real content yet in his mind to such terms as freedom, or tyranny, or even government or social relations. He has no idea what alternatives are possible or what the results are of what's so far been tried. First, he needs facts. What governments are? What kinds have been tried so far? What did they lead to? He needs an array of factual data. And then you can theorize and evaluate competing theories because you've got something to go on. Otherwise, political theory is simply adult propaganda beamed at helpless children. And the same goes, and now I think you see it's not just bias, for teaching economics in the early years. I'm against it for the same reasons. And to show you how unbiased I am here, I am against teaching philosophy in the early years for exactly the same reason. If to lecture on philosophy to someone before the mid-teens is much too abstract. It has no reality foundation yet in the student's mind, and it simply is pure propaganda. Philosophy, economics, politics, those are way up the hierarchy. They are too far removed from a child's range of experience. To get into philosophy, you need to know something about man, and that's what history gives. History doesn't give you, you see, the theories. It tells you what has actually happened. Now, you might be interested here in a conversation that I once had with Ayn Rand. I found it really fascinating in a way. I have to say I got this whole point from her, although not quite in this form. But, you know, she majored in history in college. And I remember being puzzled by that, and I asked her, oh, this was decades ago. I said to her, why did you major in history? Why do you care what men did do since you're concerned with what they should do? You know, you're a moral philosopher, and you're concerned with right or wrong. What's it, you know, the difference what they did? And she said, how am I supposed to know what men should do apart from the facts of human nature? And for that, I have to study men, actual men, what they did and what the results were. So I came back, in effect, with, well, why not just study the men around you today? Who cares what happened centuries ago? You got all the men in the world, just, you know, read the papers. Why do we need to know the past? And she gave me a terrific answer that finally made this point clear to me. She said, how will I know what facts represent man by his nature, and what is a mere historical mood or fashion? How do I know if I look around me and see that all men in all countries seem to want a ruler? They want to be conformists. If I look around today, there's tremendous evidence for that. How do I know that that isn't so on the scale applicable to the whole nature of man? Because I know that there was the Renaissance, and I know that there was the Enlightenment. I know what man was like in a different era, and therefore I am able to abstract what is the essential that runs through all eras and conditions, and what is just a local variation. I can see what endures. I can discover what effect, what causes lead to what effects, regardless of current fashions. I know what's a principle and what's just a chance variation. So she convinced me in that respect that history was a prerequisite of value judgments. It was a prerequisite of all theory and evaluation in the humanities. So I would look at it by saying history is in effect the workshop for all the humanities and social sciences, including philosophy. It is the factual base. It gives us the spectrum of what has been done, what has been proved to be possible and impossible, and thereafter you have a real basis to start to theorize. Now, history, therefore, properly taught, does not mean charts of names and dates. It does not mean when did the Babylonians start and when did they end and where did the Egyptians come in and how many this and that. It does not mean that. It does not mean the 12 causes of the Civil War or the 13 reasons why the Sumerians had orgasms. It does not mean anything. History has to be the study of principles, and it ultimately should reveal to the student the role of basic factors in shaping human life, the role of ideas, and the effects of different ideas on different societies. Now, you don't start off by preaching that. You reach it inductively by giving him the data. But ideally, what emerges at the end of a properly structured world history course across 10 years is there are certain fundamental ideas. They shape the political and cultural institutions of a society, and that has certain practical consequences. Some societies smash up, and some prosper. If he gets that much, believe me, you have taught him more. He should go on his knees and thank you. Now, if I can be so brazen, I do this not to boast, but just to give you an example. History should be taught the way I wrote it in The Ominous Parallels. I just say that because I think that's a good example. It has to be taught, in other words, as an issue of logical connection, not as accident. It has to be taught each fundamental, paving the way for the next level of practicality, and each society paving the way for the next. So it's an example of sequence and of structure. And if you teach it that way, it will certainly be tremendously relevant to today's world. Certainly relevance is important, but the moral, the way to achieve relevance, is not to teach controversial current events, as we've said. It's to teach historical principles that are applicable to all eras, including today. If they know the moral of history, believe me, you don't have to worry about their views on nuclear weapons. Of course, if you teach history properly, you'll be teaching integration because you'll be connecting all the different aspects of a society. You'll be teaching logical sequence and structure. You'll be teaching them philosophy, all of the material for philosophy without ever uttering those broad abstractions. And you will be giving them an invaluable lesson in values simply by showing them the results. History teaches values exactly the way putting your hand on a hot stove teaches values. If one lecture on the facts of the Middle Ages versus the Renaissance will instill more values in your student, assuming it's a decent lecture, than 12 lectures on these are the virtues and these are the vices. Now, I made this big thing because history has a very bad press in the United States, and everybody thinks it's extremely boring and irrelevant, and of course it's taught abysmally. They don't even teach it chronologically anymore, which is, you know, as bad as you can get. But actually, history is an invaluable subject. Third, science. Now, I mean here natural science, because in a sense, all subjects are sciences. Now, here I think there's a division of labor. Mathematics teaches a pure method. History gives the student the facts about man. Science gives him the facts about nature. So, in effect, I think history does for consciousness what science does for existence. Or you can look at it this way. History gives them the data for what one day will be ethics and politics. Science gives them the data for what one day will be metaphysics, the nature of reality. And of course, both these aspects are necessary for a man's intellectual development. Man acts in nature. So he not only has to know man, he has to know nature. If he does not know something about reality, where he's acting, what he can expect of the world, what it demands and how to deal with it, he's necessarily helpless. You know, the two cultures that this character Snow, C.P. Snow, isn't that his initials, said had to be brought together is he's absolutely right. You have to bring together the humanities and the sciences. It's a disastrous dichotomy to have the two of them confronting each other with hostility and suspicion. You have to integrate both. From science, man has to find out in the form of concretes that it's a lawful universe of cause and effect, that there are no miracles, that it is an intelligible world, that it's open to reason to understand. Now you see, I am not giving you the reason for studying science that most people give. I do not believe the purpose of teaching science is so that the student can learn scientific method. In other words, I don't believe that it's primarily for epistemological purposes that we learn science. I think all subjects equally teach epistemology if they're taught properly. That's what I tried to indicate in the previous lectures. In other words, they all teach proper thinking methods. History, just as much as science and math. I don't believe that science is more logical than history. I do think there's a value in training a child about specifically scientific methods, such as experimentation and quantification. But I don't think that this method should be made a big fuss about as such, because you are not necessarily training future scientists. What you want to train is thinkers. And scientific, concretely scientific method is of value only as an example of the broad methods you're teaching in every subject: precision, evidence, structure. And that should be available in every field. Now, just as in history and as in every subject, so in science. It's a crucial method of teaching the child the integration. That, of course, means you can't teach the child random facts or, quote, random disconnected experiments. You have to teach him connections. You have to teach him principles. Only that will communicate a cause and effect universe and proper thinking methods at the same time, which means that you have to teach him inductive laws and explanatory theories, not just a whole bunch of disconnected data. Of course, you can't give the theories before the data, but you must give the theories. You must show him the power of the mind to condense reams of otherwise disconnected data. That, in my opinion, is the whole message that he should get from science, that there's a vast sprawl of factual observations. And by a few principles or by a brilliant theory, bring it all into one comprehensible total. That's the one in the many. That is the integration that is exactly what he has to learn. So the atomic theory is a tremendously valuable thing to teach him because of the range of observable data that it subsumes and integrates. Copernicus is a wonderful thing to teach him because of the way it simplifies a whole range of observations around one heliocentric theory. It's invaluable, I would say, to teach a child at some appropriate age the progression from Tycho Brahe to Kepler to Galileo to Newton, show certain observations, and then certain laws of planetary motion integrating those observations, and then certain broader laws integrating those until you finally get to Newton. And in a small handful, the whole thing is integrated, illuminated, united. The child gets a tremendous, invaluable experience of actually bringing order out of chaos, principle out of concretes, the one out of the many. As against, if you ever know how Newton is taught, it's come without any historical background, without any idea. I'd say, Newton, this is how we were taught. Newton discovered that there were three laws of motion. Please take this down. Number one, an object in motion remains in motion unless it doesn't, and number two, force equals mass times acceleration, number three, to every action, and it's all just, well, he could have had nine. It's just like the way they teach, you know, history or anything else. Newton has three laws and Hitler has four causes, and that is utter disaster. A student should emerge from a science program not with the idea of how complicated reality is, but of how simple it is. It should not be a survey of chaos, but an introduction to principles. Now, it's a factual question which particular natural sciences best achieve this introduction. In my opinion, and here again, I do not pose as a knowledgeable person, I took physics in graduate school for a while until I had to drop out because of sheer stupidity. But I would say the curriculum should be essentially organized around physics. By my understanding, all the rest of the natural sciences are in various ways derivative, dependent on physics, or highly specialized, and not therefore lend themselves to exactly what you want from science teaching. For instance, I think astronomy apart from physics is not too much. It's really just some observed data and some surface regularities. Now, I hasten to say, I don't think astronomy should be stricken from the curriculum. I think a child, after all, lives, you have to be parochial, he lives in this solar system. So he should have something about it. About, you know, M, Jason, P, and the planets, and so, something about the galaxies. And he's a living being, he should certainly know something about biological structure and evolutionary development, and he lives on Earth, he has to know something about geology and something about the main chemicals, and so, I'm going to leave to experts to decide what of all this vast masses of data he should cover. But my point is, whatever you pick, it should always be related back to basic scientific principles and theories within the limits of the child's ability to grasp. And to my knowledge, that means taking them all back ultimately to physics. And that brings me to the last of the big four. Math, history, science, and one left, in my opinion. What? Literature, correct. That's it. Literature. Now, I don't call this English because I mean world literature. The formal teaching of English language as such I put under writing. By literature, I mean the sum total of literary art, of fiction, whether we're talking about epics, novels, plays, poems, whatever. And I do not mean dominantly contemporary literature. I think a child should get to know across his education the significant or great works from representative eras and cultures from Greece to the present. Now, of course, this has to be taught according to the ability of the child to cope with the language. It has to be graded according to difficulty. If necessary, via excerpts, simplified excerpts, even in the earlier years, with the teacher explaining the context. There are many techniques to do this. One of the best that I learned from Dr. Kelly's wife is teaching young kids Shakespeare through having them act it out, which I think is an excellent technique. But I'm not going to discuss now the forms or the techniques. That would be a whole separate course in itself. I'm saying this, in whatever form he learns it, and at whatever point, the child by the mid-teens should have familiarity with the high points from Homer to Ayn Rand. He definitely should, if it's a proper education, including Shakespeare and some Greek plays and some French romantics and some British poets, etc. I'm not even going to attempt to list the totality. Now, why do I say this? I think that this kind of study of world literature is an invaluable supplement to the other subjects. By invaluable, I don't mean just helpful, but you literally can't get along without it. And invaluable training to the conceptual faculty. Why? I want to start with the fact that literature is an art. In other words, a fine art. I remind you of the essential need of a conceptual being for art. Art is not a frill, but as Ayn Rand has shown, a need of a conceptual being. Art, if you remember, is a concretization of philosophy. It's the form in which man holds philosophy in his consciousness and is actually influenced and guided by it. It's what keeps philosophy real. Philosophy is the theory, the abstractions. Art is the model builder, the engineer. And the difference is contained in the difference between an abstract lecture on rationality and independence and reading the Fountainhead and getting the image of Rourke. So the way I look at it is like this. What history is to ethics and politics, what science is to metaphysics, art is to philosophy as a whole. It's the data, the workshop, the concretes, the instances of philosophy in specific, easily graspable terms. If history opens up the study of man and science opens up matter, art, we can say, opens up the universe as a total, or to be more exact, man's view of the universe. It gives the student the ultimate integration, man in relation to matter. Not man or the universe as such, but man in the universe. And in this sense, I think art is the ultimate integrator of the curriculum. You know the way in which philosophy is the ultimate integrator of knowledge. But in the early years, we don't deal with broad abstractions. We deal with concretes. And what art performs is to give the child concretes, concretely observable data that performs this broad integrating function in a form that he can grasp. So it's, if you want to put it in a stupidly paradoxical way, art unites history and science. That sounds like a real Hegelian triad. Now, I think, therefore, one art is essential as part of the curriculum. But now, why literature as against painting or sculpture or music? Well, I think a minor reason is that the other arts are less teachable. We don't have the objective vocabulary as we don't in music. But the major reason you should be able to figure out, literature has won from an educational point of view. Now, if you're a painter or a musician, I'm not attacking your specialty. From an educational point of view, literature has one tremendous advantage, and that is, what kind of art is it? It is the conceptual art. Its medium is concepts. So it's not only easier to teach for that reason, but you get the most out of it as a potential thinker. The other arts capture, of course, a view of life too, but they do it in perceptual terms, and therefore they can give you only certain broad essentials. But literature can capture subtle details, variants, alternatives, with a range and scope that is unique. Furthermore, in the act of reading literature, you learn a tremendous amount about concepts as such, about the use of concepts, about concepts as vehicles for the expression of thought, which is crucial even if you never intend to be a professional writer. I argued earlier today that thought involves competence in writing. Writing, which means the quality of your thinking, is significantly improved if you steep yourself in literary art, even if it is philosophically wrong. A massive exposure to the skilled, evocative use of concepts, an analysis of how it achieves precise cognitive and emotional effects, is invaluable training to your own use of concepts. Maybe you don't want or need a literary style like Shakespeare or Ayn Rand. I would still maintain that a study of it will improve your own writing on any theme. It will improve your own precision, emphasis, clarity, and to that extent, your proficiency at using words to express your own thought. Of course, let's assume it's properly taught. There is a very different importance, you see, to studying style in literature and in any other art. You may know everything there is to know about style in painting, but since it's a perceptual thing, that will not necessarily redound to improve your conceptual use. But literature properly taught is actual training in the precision of your conceptual faculty. So it's an aspect of language study, in other words, of concept study. So basically, I come out so strongly for literature because it's the conceptual art, and it's the union of both those features which make it invaluable. Now, many derivative values, if we had time, flow from this foundation. Literature is a valuable introduction to philosophy, as I've already indicated. It gives you philosophy more directly than any other subject because it is philosophy in concrete form. It is crucial in teaching values. It's an invaluable supplement to teaching values through history, because now the student is not restricted in his view of concretes to merely the historical ones. He's not restricted only to evaluating this is what has existed, but he can include types of character, types of situation, types of possibilities that never have existed because of the capacity of literature to stylize and emphasize. He can now get an idea, this is what could exist. And I just refer you for details on that to Ayn Rand and the Romantic Manifesto, to what is the title, the Psychoepistemology of Art, or the role of characterization in literature in the growing child's development. In addition, literature is a valuable supplement to the sheer knowledge of history. To gain knowledge of a period, there's nothing quite like reading its artworks. And one last propaganda in favor of literature, which is in a way unique to it. Properly taught, literature is an immediate pleasure, which no other subject is. It's fun. It's consumption, in a sense, no other subject can quite be, because it has the art element. It's stories, adventure, plots, heroes, villains, clashes. And it gives you, in addition, therefore, the message that learning can be enjoyment. Now, of course, if you ever studied Homer in school, I'm sure you would faint dead away at this characterization. But that simply is because it's taught by desiccated pedants who are interested only in parsing the language. But that is not what we're talking about here. And a curriculum which is as heavy as the one I'm advocating has got to be lightened in every way possible. So in that sense, a little dose of, you know, melodrama is terrific. Now, that is my ideal minimum curriculum. Math, history, science, literature. Now, in conclusion, I have a little extra time because we had these voracious announcements. I want to look at on and comment very briefly on several other curricular candidates, because you probably have many questions about what about X? Why don't you teach so-and-so? So I want to give you my views, just in capsule statement. I can't give you details with the time we have. Let me just preface this mop-up list by saying, I don't say it's wrong to teach other things, obviously. If, number one, they're hierarchically prepared, and two, they do not take time or focus away from the urgent subjects. And I want to say three, remember always, there is such a thing as extracurricular activities, which are not given the dignity of the curriculum, nor the time and emphasis, but can be there in peripheral form. And remember also, there are countless places to learn besides school or home. So not everything worth learning has to be taught in a curriculum. All right, now let me run through some of these. What about art and music? Those, in my opinion, are ideal for learning at home. It doesn't take anything to have music playing while the kid is brushing his teeth, to take him to a museum, etc. I don't say I'm against them in school, but in school, they have to be taught, in my opinion, as adjuncts to some other subject. For instance, you might study the literature of a period and then briefly, a quick survey of the art and music just as a taste, but I wouldn't give it focus or you're going to dilute the child's understanding. Or they could be an adjunct to history. But they are not essentials, is my point. They are peripheral to a conceptual development. What about a foreign language? Now, I do think there is a real value to learning one foreign language. I remember Miss Rand spoke French and Russian fluently, in addition to English, read and spoke them, and read German, although she didn't speak it. And she used to maintain that she had a much better grasp of any one language, in other words, any one set of concepts, by the very fact of knowing more than one language, she could abstract what is essential to language and to its use, and what is variable from one to the other. I don't dispute that. The problem is, to acquire this, it presupposes that you really learn a second language and acquire fluency in it. That is not now accomplished in the schools. All of the time spent on language training in the schools is simply thrown down the drain. It's an utter, utter waste. I had French, for instance, for 5 years, and I learned Puis-je-quitter la salle de classe, s'il vous plaît. That's it. Which we had to say before you could go to the bathroom. It's a waste. It's time down the drain. And it simply takes away a lot of time from the rest of the curriculum. So as far as a language, I would say this. If it is possible really to teach it without taking away a significant time from the other subjects, fine. But if not, throw it out. Instead, send the kid to Berlitz, where they'll teach you more in a month than he'll learn in school in 10 years. Or send him to Paris for the summer and let him live with some French people. That's a much preferable way, I think, than to sit there and study it in school. Now, what about philosophy as such, rather than in the indirect methods I've been indicating? No, as I said, I think that is much too abstract to teach. If a student is not going to go on to college, I could countenance, say, a brief introduction and survey in his last year or so of high school. Just enough so he has an orienting introduction so he can pursue it on his own thereafter, but not until then. And the same goes for all of the humanities that we learn in college. Political science, economics, psychology, etc. All of them should be kept out until the very last year. And there it's really a transition to him becoming a self-sustaining adult. I just have to say with regard to psychology that this would be true when there's something that to be taught. As of today, there's very little to teach even in college, let alone in high school, in terms of legitimate theories. I exempt Dr. Packer, but we need to have a whole science before we can give it a curriculum place. What about religion? I would teach religion as part of history, as an example of an influential factor on history and what its actual influence was. What about shop, manual training, home economics, sewing, that whole axis? A complete waste of time. Nothing to do with conceptual training or cognition. Insofar as these skills are desirable, they should be learned on your own or send a kid to some sweatshop to learn it from an employer, not from a teacher in school. What about physical education? Sound mind and a sound body. Well, that's a Greek ideal, but it is a waste of time in school. Let the parents have the kids do sit-ups at home. I do not think time should be taken away unless you could say that the sheer concentration for so many hours has to be broken up by something. So you want them to play baseball or whatever. But then you're not doing it as a curricular subject, you're doing it as recess. And I mean, who can be against recess? What about driver training, sex education, health, citizenship education, education in drug abuse, etc.? No. All of that just overloads and wrecks the curriculum. If you have a child and you want him to drive, take him out someday and teach him or enroll him in a class. Don't put that in along with math and history. That is a complete corruption to do that. Certainly teach him about the pill, but he doesn't need, today's high school teachers to tell him when to swallow it or her. Now, lastly, What about teaching values? Values as such in a formal, organized way. I think that's in the same situation as philosophy. It's too early until the mid-teens. You cannot, I think we said this earlier in this course, take toddlers, sit them down and say, even however simplified, life is the standard, egoism defines the beneficiary, trader principle defines social relations, and that's hopeless. You need to give him multiple concretes first. He has to experience life supplemented by what he learns from literature and history, and then he has all the material. And in fact, I think the only real thing you can do in these early years is to teach proper values by the way the whole education is set up. And here I think objectivist education blends perfectly with the objectivist code of values. Because the essence of the education I've been outlining is training minds. And if you encourage and focus on and reward minds, that, according to objectivism, does consist of teaching values, because for objectivism, the primary value is the mind. So every time you give a child a proper motivation and you tell him this is going to enhance your power of understanding, every time you teach him structure or integration or the proper method, you're teaching him the value of thinking, of connecting, of logic. Every time you give him a proper conceptual subject and expand his understanding, in other words, every day and every way, you are upholding for him in concrete form the paramount value of thought. If you do this properly, you do not have to give him a special lecture and say, man's means of cognition is thought and so on. He will know it. By the time he gets to Atlas Shrugged, it'll be self-evident to him. And not only thought, but all of its consequences. If you properly teach history, literature, and so on, the child will absorb all of the values of independence and individuality and self-esteem, etc. Now, there's only really one further concrete-oriented way to inculcate values beyond the curricular subject matter. And that is by the actual practical daily requirements of the institution, whether at home or school. In other words, the actual rules of living that the child must obey. In other words, he gets his value orientation partly cognitively from his own observations, the subject matters you're taught, teaching him, and so on, and partly by simply living and finding out what his life requires of him. And school is a form of life. It's a very profoundly important form of life to these young kids. So the rules that you institute are very important in teaching a kid certain values. Now, for instance, this is from an adult college context, but it's all I have time for, and it'll give you an example of what I mean. This is a letter I got several years ago from a college graduate. He's talking about an experience that occurred, and I'll quote now, my first year at the University of California at Berkeley in 1963. I went to the dean of students to discuss a problem with the food at the dormitories. When I approached him, he asked what group I represented. When I said that I represented only myself, he said that he was not interested in individual views and that he would hear me out only if I represented a group. I protested that my views were as important as those of any group representative, and he countered that I could starve to death if I didn't like the food and told me to leave. The message was a clear preview of my entire education at Berkeley. The individual never counted there, only the group, which seemed to have an identity and life of its own. I attended UC in the 60s and have not been the same since. Now, if you have years of that kind of collectivism, not taught necessarily, but just a requirement of existence, you can't move without a group, you can't live blocks without the group, you can't do anything without the group, you are certainly going to turn out collectivists who share collectivist values. By the same token, if you have rational living conditions, you will turn out rational individualists also, and that is a very valuable adjunct. Okay, let's draw a line here on curriculum. Thank you. Okay, I have a few written questions on education. I'm sure there's many more on education in that box, but I haven't distinguished them yet, so I don't know which are which. I quoted the art of teaching. Would I give the bibliographical data? Yes, this is a helpful little book, The Art of Teaching by Gilbert Hyatt, H-I-G-H-E-T. I happen to have a vintage paperback from 1950. This was a classical scholar at Columbia, and he had some interesting tips and advice. Also, I want to, while I'm at it, recommend with all the appropriate qualifications this book by Jacques Barzun, B-A-R-Z-U-N, called Teacher in America. A lot of good information mixed in with a lot of less good, but nevertheless, an educated, classically educated man has some good things in it too. Those I would recommend. And then this question has a PS. Do you advocate instruction and teaching for college and grade school, graduate school professors? I'm going to answer that in our last class on Saturday when we get to what kind of teaching should teachers have. Now, I had a question that I deferred from last time, which I want to comment on briefly. What do I think of the Montessori method? Well, generally, I am very favorable to it. I think she was a remarkable, brilliant woman, an educator. I think that the things that she does in the early years, from what is it, 2.5 it starts through, 5, 6, whatever, are wonderful training to the young mind in reaching the conceptual level and acquiring the existential life skills that are necessary. It's brilliantly graded. The steps of flowing out from the perceptual to the conceptual level are very well done. I think the single most brilliant thing is the idea of teaching writing before reading, because it makes reading like an automatic self-evident consequence. So there's no doubt that this is a marvelous thing. This does not mean that I am an advocate of Montessori past a certain age. Now, let me say that, as a preface here, my knowledge of Montessori is extremely limited. I am not an expert. I have not gone to Montessori schools. I've read very little. Therefore, if I make a criticism, as I am about to, it's on the basis of the smattering of knowledge I have. I believe that fully conceptual training, with all of its requirements, should start very young, at 6 or 7. I do not see going any further on the perceptual level past that point. So, as I understand it, and I stress my limitations of the knowledge of what Montessori is advocating, the knowledge is not useful after about 6. At that point, I would say go into, although in a simplified form, purely conceptual, no longer evolved from the perceptual. So that there are some things that I hear Montessori advocates say, which I think are fine on the perceptual level, but which I would not advocate. I'm not going to give you a whole list, but for instance, I do not believe in what's called freedom in education. Even freedom within structure. I believe the more conceptual the material, the more sequence must take over. You must go on a logical scale of development. There are no options if you're teaching essentials. And therefore, I'm uneasy at the idea of, well, we're going to give you a principle, then you go and follow your own bent. Kids in conceptual material are simply too ignorant. They do not know where to go. Now, of course, if you say, but I delimit the area of freedom so tremendously, And it's within such a firm structure that this problem doesn't come up, fine, then who could be against it? But my understanding is that there is more, quote, freedom, more latitude for the kid to fall on his own when I don't think he's ready than I would countenance. The same thing is, I do not like the idea of a child doing his own research. I don't, for instance, now I'm not sure that this is Montessori, but I don't believe a kid should be his own historian and go and study original documents. He doesn't know what it's all about at this stage. He needs someone to spoon feed him, and I'm all in favor of that. Tell him the principles, give him the framework. Research is a later phenomenon. By the same token, I think there's a limited value to what's called materializing for the child. It's very nice to have blocks and charts and so on early, but I don't think you need it after a certain age. You need concretes. You don't want floating abstractions, but that doesn't mean they have to be visualizable or tactile. So, in my view, Montessori is very good at the outset, and in what is then done with it is what's important. But I think it should go right to a purely conceptual form of teaching as young as the kids, as the traffic will bear. That's about all I wanted to say. That's not necessarily a criticism of a Montessori school, because maybe there's a lot of variations and they may very well do that. So I'm really talking only from, as I say, a smattering of knowledge. Now let's take questions on the curriculum that we covered today. Yes?
How do you value the study of foreign literature in the foreign language itself?
You're going to value the study of literature in the foreign language itself. Oh, definitely a value. You can get things out of the original that you can't get out of any translation. You know, because the actual complete skill of the individual is essentially tied up with his ability to use those words in his language, in his syntax, to achieve all the effects, including the stylistic effects. But that doesn't mean that that isn't essential. If you want to learn Greek and Latin and French and German and so on, if you could do it all, I would enhance it. But I don't think that the time it required makes it worthwhile. Much better to read more literature in English translation, if that's all you have, because you really have to acquire the knowledge of the language. Otherwise, if you read it the way, you know, we read Greek and Latin and so on in school, puer est in, and you look up in means in, and so by the time you get through two sentences, you lost the whole context anyway, so it's a waste. Yes, at the back.
Yeah, can you tell me what your opinion is of a curriculum in which performance would be the standard and time is the variable?
Oh, you asked me that in writing and I didn't understand it. Do you want to explain that?
Well, we're saying a certain mathematical body of knowledge or a certain proficiency in grammar, where you stay at that level until you get to a certain proficiency, to 85%. So you wouldn't have grades as you do now. You'd have, say, courses, and you would stay in that course until you get...
Well, I don't see that they're mutually exclusive. The question is, shouldn't, instead of having grades, shouldn't you have a system whereby the person takes a course and has to keep at that level until he reaches a certain degree of proficiency? I would advocate both. I don't believe in automatically passing a student just because he finished a year. They didn't even do that in the old days. You know, you don't have to be an objectivist to advocate that. That's only the modern idea that everybody should have an education, no matter whether they have the brains and the motivation, and therefore everybody has to pass to make room for the next everybody. But that's absurd. In the old days, they used to be failing kids. They said, you can't go to grade 3. You just didn't master grade 2, so you just have to sit there. And when they reach 12, they leave. I mean, there's no other way you can do it, but that's not incompatible with grading. Because one way you find out whether he knows the material is to give him a test.
Somebody over here. Yes.
If you were writing a curriculum in history for grades K through 12...
You want me to go into detail?
How would you structure that history curriculum?
You're asking me beyond my area of competence. I have ideas in that, but I don't want to dogmatize on that, and I don't want to get that concrete. How would I structure a history curriculum from kindergarten to grade 12? That is too big a subject. I would not give him, in effect, But I'm just giving you the tip of the iceberg. I would not give him, in effect, start with Adam and Eve in kindergarten and end up with World War II in grade 12. No, I wouldn't do that. I would pick certain periods that I think well exemplify the kind of principles I want to indicate, and I would give him those at a certain level, and then only later introduce broader and more continuity when he grasped the idea of what a society is, what structure is, how the various aspects interconnect. And you would have to very much simplify it. And I would certainly ignore the whole East and concentrate only on Western civilization. And I would have to pick out from each era only those things that he can grasp. If he's 8 years old, you can discuss the Magna Carta with him. You have to, you know, pick out what type of thing can he understand at this level. So it would be far from me to, you'd have to be an expert in history to do that, which I am not, unfortunately. Yeah.
Can you be specific about teaching rational living? How, when, and when?
Well, that's another thing. You want me to be specific about rational living. Every procedure in the school, is all I can say as a general answer, has to be calculated and not simply taken over by tradition. Every procedure, the grading procedure, what the child does if there's an injustice, what demands he can make and how he relates to the group, what you're going to do with him if he doesn't want to play with the other kids, how you treat absenteeism. I mean, every single aspect, what you do to discipline, which is a very crucial question in education. Every aspect has to be geared so that you inculcate a certain attitude toward himself, his powers, others, and so on. That is not something I could give you as a quick condensed summary any more than I could take any one of these other points. It has to be mapped out across. That's exactly the function of the owner of a school. Is exactly, that should be his life work, to figure out exactly how to organize these things and including the rules of living. But a philosopher is exempt from, you know, philosophers know everything in general and nothing in particular.
Yes, one question per person. Yes.
From your example on your science, are you implying that scientific history is the best way to teach science as a structure?
No, I want to say scientific history is the best way to teach science, but I certainly think it is one very crucial way to teach science. Because scientific history is not largely accidental. It's largely determined by the hierarchy of knowledge. It's the most rational field there is, because you build knowledge on knowledge. And therefore, and also, since the method is controlled, you don't throw out the old knowledge with the new, you incorporate it. And therefore, it is one invaluable curricular method. It's not the only way, nor do you have to start a kid, you know, in grade one and say, well, now Kepler said this. I mean, you don't have to do that. You have to start with what he can understand. But at some point, as an integrating device, the history of science is uniquely valuable, much more so than the history of any other field. At the very back.
Is homework important?
Can we?
Is homework important, and how much is necessary?
Is homework important and how much is necessary? Some homework is certainly important, simply because the child has to digest the material. He can't get it just in class. He has to think on his own. See, now I'm very strongly in favor of the child doing things on his own, but not in school. I think he should do it on his own at home, and that's called homework. So in that sense, definitely yes. It should be geared to what is required to digest the material, to apply it, to integrate it, to connect it to other things, to make it part of his own life, and to drill him where there's material that has to be automatized. How much depends on the subject matter and on the age of the kid. I don't think you can list an arbitrary amount. He should maybe do a half hour or an hour a night in the early years and then progressively go up, until by the end he should be doing several hours a day by the time he gets to the later high school grades. if it's to have an intensive education. Now, some kids are so bright they don't need it. If they don't need it, I wouldn't penalize them and say, you got to do your homework because that's a metaphysical law. If he already can digest it, he knows everything, let him play baseball or whatever he wants. But if we're talking about the average person learning, will take the average amount of time that he should have to do it. But I don't say how many hours. It depends on his capacity, his age, and the requirements of the material. Yes, Jim.
Yeah, well, it obviously should be taught at home. Do you think introspection is a part of education? And when and how should it be taught?
You have to ask Dr. Packer that. Do I think introspection is a part of education and how should it be taught? I only concentrate on extrospection. Certainly, the child has to know something about himself and his feelings. I do not see that this should be taught in the schools. I would be terrified of a school who would take my child and tell her how she should come in contact with her own self. I think that is too personal, too private, and I wouldn't trust any other educator to do that. So I think that kind of advice you should get in the ordinary course of living. You shouldn't have a course, as far as I can see, in introspecting. But if the child is troubled, you can, or happy or whatever, you can start on an early level to ask them, why did they feel you seem to be this? You know, are you and why and etc. till it becomes a normal part of life that the child's emotions or inner states are also subject to scrutiny and study and, you know, but in a very natural, simple, concrete, oriented way without a big song and dance about this is introspection and this is your duty to psychological health or, you know, any of that. In other words, I think parents have a responsibility to teach a tremendous amount as part of life, which is not part of a curriculum. You see what I mean? And one of the big errors today is that anything worth learning should be taught by Miss Smith, you know, in school, which is absurd. Absurd, because then Miss Smith doesn't know whether she's coming or going. Yes, in the green.
Can you say anything in general about discipline?
Anything in general about discipline? Well, there should be some a child, however, in an educational context that requires too much discipline, you have to stop the whole process. Because discipline means he's not motivated. And if he's not motivated, you're not going to get anywhere anyway. Now, maybe he's beyond motivation. Maybe, you know, he's just so neurotic or whatever that you can't educate him. But then get him out of class so he doesn't bother the other students. Take him to a psychiatrist, do whatever you can, but he's outside the province of education. So we can only talk about education within the framework that it is a peripheral thing. And it won't be that big a problem if the kids are cognitively and motivationally prepared for what you're teaching. But then there will still, of course, kids have free will and they will still misuse their faculties and be obstreperous, etc. And I think there you have to combine understanding with firmness. Sometimes you just have to dismiss it and not make a big thing, and sometimes you have to make a big thing and punish the child. And it depends really how grave is the offense, how repeated is the offense, and what are the consequences of it. Now, I myself, at this stage, let me say, within the context of my present knowledge, which is admittedly limited, do not favor corporal punishment, neither by parents nor children, teachers, nor children either. I do not see that it has to be the case that you have to whip a child or hit him or whatever in order to inculcate a lesson. Now, one of the lecturers made a point that if it's a life-threatening situation, and the only way you can stop the child from doing it is to smack him. Better to smack him than to have him run over by a truck. I don't deny that. To me, it's at least a question. Is that necessarily the case, or isn't there a way, not to put too fine a point of it, of screaming at him in so traumatic a way that that would stop it without actually hitting him? That's what I propose to try first. Now, if it doesn't work, you know, I will certainly go to the next stage. But my hope at this point is that it will not be necessary to resort to corporal punishment. I think basically punishment should fit the crime, and the best form of punishment is to segregate the misbehaving individual from the rest, whether it's the adults or the rest of the class, on the grounds that you are not behaving, you know, in a way that is adult enough for this situation. You're behaving like a baby, so you have to stay away from people. We're trying to accomplish something or talk or whatever, so if you want to do this, go off and do it by yourself. And that, to me, is the best single way. I'm more dubious about removing advantages arbitrarily. In other words, the kid has been promised to go to the circus for 6 months, and then he doesn't eat beans, you say, okay, for that you can't go to the circus. I don't believe in that. There should be some perceptible connection, you know, between the crime and the punishment, and not, you know, give him the feeling that this capricious establishment has descended on him. But as I say, this is a whole subject, and if you come back maybe in 15 years, I'll have more information. We have time for more. Is that one last question? Yes.
The teaching of logic through simple computer programming to very young children seems to have had a profound result on their ability to think logically. Do you see that becoming an additional subject besides what you've named?
Do I see the teaching of logic, which you say has had a profound effect on their ability to think logically through computer programming, as an essential or a valuable adjunct? I don't know much about it, but I do not. I am not a computer bug. I do not know anything taught by a computer that couldn't be taught better by a person. I retain my unreconstructed view that abstractions taught too early are not of great value, and abstract patterns of thought taught too early are not of great value. I think there are terrific computer games, which I love to play myself. You know, you press the button and you're given a math problem, and then you hear the voice saying wrong, you know. And so, I mean, that's a lot of fun, and I don't deny that those things have peripheral value. I do not think computers are a revolution in education. Now, I may be ignorant, maybe there are things being done there that I don't know, but I am not a computer maniac. I don't own one, and consequently, you have to write me off as unreconstructed primitive from another era. Thank you very much.